Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. YouTubers, hi. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, it is time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up, and boy, did we have an interesting weekend of basketball, both on the W front, had some news we're going to get to, also on the NBA front, in which I just have to apologize to anyone that was in the Bleacher Report stream that we did on Friday, where it was like, hey, we're leaving off these big names because we think they're going to return, and one of the players on the list was Naz Reid, and then Naz Reid gets an extension with Minnesota, so it's like, well, probably could have added someone to the list, but that's neither here nor there. We will start on the NBA side, though. We'll talk about Naz in a little bit. We had a trade pop off yesterday. John Collins was finally traded from the Atlanta Hawks after multiple seasons worth of trade rumors, him being asked about it, saying, I'm just going to do my job. I hear the noise. I can only focus on what I can control, etc. John Collins traded to the Utah Jazz. Didn't have that on the bingo card. John Collins traded to the Utah Jazz for Rudy Gay and a future second round pick. Absolutely didn't have that on the bingo card. Steve is raising his hand.
Just quick question before you go in to the trade. More disappointing finale, Game of Thrones or the John Collins trade saga?
I don't know how to answer this without it being a shot of some sort. I'm going to say Game of Thrones.
Oh, wow.
I'll just say the expectation level was a little bit higher. And so when that didn't hit, it was a little bit, you know.
So you're saying there's an icebox where your heart used to be?
I'm so cold. So cold. I'm so cold.
But so, so is the Night King. Anyways.
You know what? All right, man. Oh, I found myself in a thinking loop about this trade after it happened, after getting over the initial shock of, wow, this is how it ended, huh? All these, hey, we want multiple firsts for John Collins, or we want a young player plus a pick. We want this, we want this. And it's Rudy Gay and a second round pick to essentially clear cap or just avoid the tax or that second apron. It's like, that's disappointing. And then I got to like the roster thoughts of this. And I have a lot, so I will concede the floor to you first. I know I feel like I'm going to end up rambling on this. What were your initial thoughts on the John Collins trade?
Woo! I did not see that coming. At all. That was thought number one. I was like, wait a minute. This is how this ends? John Collins to Utah for a second round pick in Rudy Gay? No disrespect to Rudy Gay. Shout out to Rudy Gay. I did not see that being the series finale of John Collins in Atlanta. I think the fact that it came out beforehand that, hey, Atlanta has been told they need to cut some money. When you add that to this actual trade, it's like, okay, that makes a little bit of sense. They were trying to let us know what was going on. I think for me, one, you could see more teams trying to use their space with trades, in a sense, and not just tying themselves to free agency, whether it's renting out a contract for a year or saying, hey, we'll go ahead and use the space this way. The second apron is going to have me in a headlock for a very long time. I just apologize for that right off the rip because it's like they got this huge trade exception and they could go into the luxury tax, but also, hey, could you not do that if at all possible? And then there's also the point where these teams now, as I've started to read, they now have to spend a certain amount of money by the start of the season. And so I wonder how much of that is going to impact things. But it just kind of felt like the end of the road for John Collins in Atlanta. I think John Collins has a lot of talent. I don't think he's done as a basketball player, but you look at where he was in Atlanta and then where he ended up at the end. John Collins, one of the most dynamic pick and roll players we had seen. Each year, it felt like that took a step down. The roles just stopped happening. Like there was a time where we were like, hey, can Atlanta go small? Can John Collins play the five? Is that their best lineup? And the answer was they didn't want him to do it defensively. Then they got Clint Capella. And then teams started switching his pick and roll. And then they didn't really post him up a ton. And then he was just kind of spaced
Yeah.
I think we got Donovan Mitchell guards John Collins. And I was like,
you can't.
Oh, that's on purpose. And then you throw in the shooting going backwards. And so now if you are just a spacer to a degree and you are not making the shots, how are we getting you involved offensively? So I just think it was time. So they needed to pivot. They made that move. We'll see what it opens up for them. I know you have thoughts, but they do have a lot of those guys who can kind of play three and four in theory.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's just, hey, we go smaller. We got our bigs that screen and then we just play out of it. So it might just be a philosophy change right there. That's what I got to start. Where were you at with it?
Woo. Well, just to briefly bounce off of what you were saying about kind of a shift for Atlanta. This reminds me of the conversation we were having during the first round series against Boston this year, where I was just kind of like, hey, if this is how you're using John Collins or not using John Collins, because Clint Capela is still your primary screen setter, you're just spacing John Collins a bunch, why not just play Sadiq Bey at the four if this is where it's going to go? And I made that thought and was like, well, the defense isn't great, and it was not great in the Sadiq Bey minutes, but it's like, if this is the offensive role, like you just have to get a shooter in there, because emblematic of all of this, Atlanta's shot profile was just a mess this year. You trade for DeJounte Murray, and I was high on the fit coming in. Like, it's probably too early for me to just take the complete L on it, but the first year was not great for DeJounte in Atlanta, despite DeJounte actually being pretty good. It's just the overall fit didn't hit the way Atlanta wanted it to, especially once you factor in what they sent out to bring DeJounte in. But it was a heavy mid-range, not a lot of shots at the rim until Quinn Snyder got there, and they just did not take threes. And you get the early returns from Quinn Snyder, some of the sets he's running, all the good stuff. But you ask the players post-game, pre-game, like, hey, what's been the biggest shift with Quinn? What is he be telling you guys? Every player that's been asked that question, if you go back through like the media files and stuff like that, is, oh, he wants us to take more threes. He wants us to play with more pace. He wants us to get more threes up. That kind of contradicts what you're doing with John Collins. Like, you used him as a spacer, but that's not his natural flow. Like, in an ideal situation, it's, oh, snap, he can shoot too. And to your point, he was a dynamic pick and roll threat. A guy that can kill you with slips, a guy that can roll a real vertical spacer in that regard, and also a true pick and pop threat. What intrigued me about John Collins as a pick and pop guy, or just a shooter in general, you see bigs that can step out to the corners and knock down shots. It's like, okay, this is a nice relief shot. What was fun about the shooting development for John Collins was that the majority of his threes were coming from above the break. Like, these were the high value threes for John Collins. And so that opens up the pick and pops, that opens up the pop and drive for him, who throughout his career, he got to the point where he could take a couple of dribbles and make a move. And like, that's kind of all you need when you're playing with a pick and roll creator like Trae Young. Just abuse the space that's going to be afforded to you. And he did that. And, you know, just to bounce off what you said, it did feel like it went backwards with teams switching more. I was looking that up yesterday. Like, it felt like there were more switches for John Collins. What is the actual number on this? So I went through, like, okay, how many picks was he setting? And how often were they switched? So going back to his rookie year, pick set per 100 possessions. About 45 in year one, 11% of those were switched. The next year, 49 per 100, about 16% of those were switched. In 1920, his best offensive season, this is when he averaged nearly 22-10, shot 40% for three, all the good stuff. Roughly 54 picks set per 100 possessions for John Collins. Easily the highest of his career. About 12% of those were switched. They get Clint Capela in, it goes from 54 to 39. 19% of those were switched. The year after, 34 per 100. 25% of those were switched. Last year, 19 picks set per 100 possessions for John Collins. Nearly 30% of those were switched. And if that's where it's going, like, yeah, Atlanta has to make a move. And it's odd because it felt like the writing was on the wall for a minute. Look, hey, if you don't feel comfortable with him playing the five defensively, he's not going to get to play the five. And if he's pigeonholed at the four, you need real shooting development to where it's not just high percentage on three attempts. He's going to have to become a six attempt guy on good efficiency if that's going to work. He didn't do that because that's not his game. And to your point, not him not posting up often and him not being the best post-up guy against switches, period, he wasn't going to get a high volume of that either. It was just a weird bit of utilization of John Collins And then when you zoom out and look at what the actual Hawks personnel was over the last couple of years, and then you factor in injuries on top of that, it just never felt like there was a way to really maximize what he could be in Atlanta. Like, some of that's on him just because the development wasn't there, but the context also wasn't super great for him outside of I have Trae Young. And once some more of that volume started shifting to Clint Capela as a ball, as a pick and roll partner, he got left out to dry a little bit. And so now as we get to John Collins in Utah, I wonder, one, will he be used in different ways? And I think based on what Will Hardy did in Utah last year, I think the easy answer to that is yes. But then I kind of look at, okay, who's the guard he's going to be with? Because he is leaving Trae, and the best pick and roll partner in Utah right now is what? We don't know Jordan Clarkson's back. It's Colin Sexton, who, going back through some film, he's made passing growth since his days in Cleveland for sure. But like, he's not Trae as a ball handler. He's not Trae as an inventive passer. And so I just wonder, what are those opportunities going to look like in light of, and then beyond that, what are the lineups going to look like? I would imagine we see some three big units, or three big, quote unquote, if you're still sticking with Laurie at the three, Collins at the four, Walker Kessler at the five. Like, let's see what that looks like. Is he still going to see the switching problem? And if so, is this the context in which that doesn't matter as much as it did in Atlanta? Because I do think the spacing in Utah is better than what it was in Atlanta last year. We shall see. I'm just kind of curious about the fit. I think it's a fair bet for Atlanta, for Utah to make. Maybe it's just cap space. You send out Rudy Gay in a second and you get a guy that is as talented as John Collins, especially when he's healthy. I think the shooting bounces back, assuming the hand is right heading into next season. It's a fair bet, but I do also wonder, will he be maximized here too? Because from a scheme perspective, I think he can be, or at least in a way that he wasn't in Atlanta. But from a personnel standpoint, I'm not sure yet. I just need to see what the rest of the offseason looks like. Is that fair?
I mean, yeah, it's fair. For me, I think this is one of the better landing spots for John Collins. This is one of the better contexts for John Collins. When you look at the work that Utah did last year with Jared Vanderbilt at the start, playing with Lauri Markkanen and Kelly Olynyk, and him basically being the five, quote unquote, and roaming and screening and being able to space, be at the dunker, be involved in handoffs. It's the variety of actions for Utah that stands out to me.
Mm-hmm.
It is the movement that they have. So it's not going to be stagnant. He's going to be asked to do more than one thing. So I think the context is going to help him out better. Even if the guard play takes a step back, there may be less of a desire for teams to switch. If there's more pace, there's more tempo, we're not as worried about the ball handler, we may give you base coverage. If John Collins gets base coverage again, probably looks a lot different. And also, it's a different set of results. Atlanta had to win during this stretch. Once they made that conference finals run, they took that and said, nope, we're here. Now, they weren't, but they made moves as if they were. And those moves didn't really accelerate the growth of John Collins, as we've discussed. I think being in Utah, where the expectations are lower, where the usage is going to be there, probably more freedom. Just, I think the overall context changing is more important for John Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the best space that he could ask for because of the experience that Utah has with multiple bigs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a win for him.
Okay, that makes sense. Like, I also think it's a win for him overall. I just wonder, like, if the goal is we will get the 100 percentile version of John Collins, like, is Utah the spot because of, like, lineup personnel, stuff like that. But I think, again, this context is just better for him than Atlanta's, period. I think we both agree there. And I would also say, like, I saw some rumblings like, hey, why trade for John Collins when you just drafted Taylor Hendricks, stuff like that. And, like, I think that's also fair. I do think, I guess based on what happens with Kelly Olynyk and stuff, like, I do think there are going to be more minutes at the five for John Collins. I guess he would just be the pseudo backup five for them. Like, there is more of a pathway to him to get those reps than he did in Atlanta. Because as we talked about a little bit earlier, like, one, they just didn't trust him enough defensively to do that. And even when he made growth, because I think he did grow as a defender at the five, look solid at the level. They also couldn't really afford to do that because they had Onyeka Okongwu in the wings, which to the Atlanta side, he becomes even more important. His development becomes even more important heading into next season. There were There were some pretty big stretches last year where it felt like Onyeka is just their best center. And so I'm curious to see how he's able to build upon that and what that looks like next year. But back to the Utah side, I do think there's going to be some minutes for John Collins at the five. And I think that will alleviate some of the will they switch this stuff. And depending on what the rest of the personnel will be in those kind of lineups, I think you can have a lot of fun there. So I'm excited to see that. If I can flip this to Atlanta very quickly, like this very much feels like a bit of a reckoning for them. Again, I don't think the quote unquote asset management of John Collins was great over the last few years. And it culminates in let's save money with a dude that's this talented. But we do now have a full offseason for Atlanta to kind of reshape their roster, however they want to do so. We've seen the reports. I think Brian Windhorst was one of the guys that said it. Like, pretty much everyone not named Trae Young is on the table right now. So we may see more drastic shifts. Like, we've seen Clint Capella's name linked to the Dallas Mavericks, for example. I don't know what moves are coming. I do think the full offseason to reshape things, plus we are now going into the first full year of the Quinn Snyder experience. And you bounce back to the /3-point comments that the players have made, that he's made as well. I'm excited to see what Atlanta does and how they really want to build around this. I would be surprised if DeJounte is moved. I say this as someone with no sources. Just want to throw that out there. But I would be surprised if DeJounte is moved. And if he isn't, how small does Atlanta want to go? How much do they prioritize the three ball? Do they go with Sadiq starting at the four? Do they move Jalen Johnson into the starting lineup? Do they target someone else to start? Like, I do wonder, like, how they want to shake it. Because I do think Quinn just generally wants a spacier, speedier type of play.
I would guess that we see more of those wings turn into fours for Atlanta, if I had to guess right now. And then let's try and play as many of these two guard lineups as we can and live that way. What are your thoughts?
I think that's fair. Like, again, like, I think at the very least, we see more Sadiq. The slide in there is like, okay, cool. If we do keep Clint, or if Clint's moved and we trade and we slot Onyeka in as the starter and he just takes that job now, like, it does make sense to have like a high volume bomber at the four to really spread things out, especially if you're sticking with Trae and DeJounte, in which DeJounte was fine on catch and shoot threes last year. Was it enough to really bend defenses and force hard closeouts? Not really. And like most of Trae's, one, the 3-point shooting took a step back for Trae Young last year after the career year the year before. But most of Trae's threes are coming off the bounce, so it's not the same level of gravity as you would get from like an off-ball bomber. So, like, I think they need to prioritize the spacing 3 through 5 as much as they can, which also makes me wonder if the Hawks are still going to make another, like, big salary move this offseason. If it's not Clint, it's probably going to be DeAndre Hunter. Just reading tea leaves, there's another guy that's just been linked to different places and has had his name in the rumor mill, because he's also not the high-volume 3-point shooter to make defenses, like, think. And in light of, you know, the pace thing that Quinn would want, in terms of, you know, pushing after misses, but also just quicker decision-making in the half court, DeAndre has never really fit that mold either. And that's typically looked better when he's been at the four. I wouldn't be surprised if we see something there. But I'm with you. Like, I do think it's just going to be the threes going to fours and just trending a little bit smaller alongside whoever that five is going to be. And I guess on the three front, it's going to be cool to see more AJ Griffin in year two. Because he was quietly one of the better rookies last year for just falling out of the rotation for a bit in March and stuff. But they're going to need his shooting and his secondary playmaking. Showed some nice flashes last year. So it's going to be cool to see that. But the Hawks have some questions. Did you have a thought?
Well, no, I'm going back to those Utah teams. Conley Mitchell, Royce O'Neal, Bogdanović, Rudy Gobert. Is Quinn trying to get to that? And you say, hey, I'm excited to see some more AJ. You go see some more Bogdanović, buddy.
Boy, are we. It's just how much more will we see of him? Because it's just the health for him. You know, when he's there, secondary playmaking is going to be there. The shooting is going to be there, either on ball or off movement. Like, he's a very valuable piece for this team. He just hasn't been able to string together healthy seasons. And that's going to be the quick question mark. He also has. He just got an extension this past season, which caught everyone by surprise, and we talked about it a little bit on the pod. But yeah, like, it's going to be some interesting stuff in Atlanta. I think also Atlanta's just an interesting case study of the whole like second apron thing. Like, hey, man, if this ain't working, we are not about to be spending this. We will make a move. And it's also a little bit of a case study. And maybe this is just me galaxy braining it. But just like the four like John Collins. To where he can shoot. He does have some ball skills, but it's not enough for him to be like a real like modern four. And he can do some weak side stuff. He can operate at the level at the five, but he's not a pure five or like your ideal small ball five. If that makes sense. He's switchable, but not high level switchable. And so like those players in general, as the league progresses forward, are going to be harder to build around. And then once you add in the salary slot, it's also like, OK, what do we do here? Like it has to be really good or better context for him to work. And it clearly wasn't Atlanta. And so I'm curious to see like what the players of John Collins mold looks like moving forward and how teams kind of game plan for guys that, again, he's really good. Like last year was, you know, aside from the rookie year, like the worst offensive season he's had. But even then, he quietly made like over 60% of his twos. It's not like he couldn't finish. It's just the shooting went backwards. And just the general usage of him went the other way. So like there are uses for John Collins. I don't want to, no one should lose sight of the fact that he's actually a really good basketball player. Mm-hmm. It is just, it's a tough archetype to build around if it's not upper tier elite talent, and he is a sub elite talent, even though he's really good. So it's a fascinating like team building situation as well. But
he is this will be the interesting part to see. Was he a victim of the context, or is this just who he is? Because again, this is probably the best place for him to showcase some of that versatility. But with these players that are quote unquote fours, you've got to add something to your game to give you that staying power. Maybe you don't have to be a knockdown shooter, but can you knock down these shots? Can you drive closeouts? Can you mix in a roll? Just how much can you put back on the table for us? With John Collins, it got into a really weird place in Atlanta where it just got away from it. So now we're going to see, was that just the Atlanta context, or this is where John Collins is thought of in the league? Like I always say, you don't want this to become your story.
Yeah.
And if that carries from Atlanta to Utah, then he's got some real mirror conversations to have. But if he's able to bounce back, get away from the switching, be more involved, then we see, you know, we're 6 months away from John Collins having an impact for the Utah Jazz. Most improved player. Da-da-da-da-da.
Can't wait to drop the Steve. Which player caught your eye this week? John Collins averaging 23-12.
Yep.
In his first day. Yeah. But to that point, like that's where, again, the switching numbers really do come into play, to your point. Again, last year, only set 19 on-ball picks per 100 possessions. And almost 30% of those were switched. And I was like, okay, is that number 19 because the switching number is going up? Or is the switching number going up because they aren't using him that much? Like it's the chicken or the egg type thing. And I'm excited to see if the different context in Utah makes that a little bit different. And heck, if him being able to just play the five more than he could in Atlanta, if that shifts that enough and they're able to have some fun from there. So we will keep an eye on it. I guess just an obligatory shout out to Rudy Gay. We will see if he has a role in Atlanta. That was Mark Schindler and Mark Schindler only. Moving to a little bit more NBA news. Naz Reid, as I made the early apology to kick off the podcast, 3-year, $42 million deal, player option in the third year, average career highs in points, rebounds, and 2-point percentage last year, almost 12 points, about 5 boards, 65% on twos. I am intrigued. Like, one, shout out Naz Reid for earning the money that he did, because that man played well last year. But also, in big red letters, that is $342 for Naz Reid, and I am not even going to cite the Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns contracts.
Why not? The people need to know. Inform the public.
Rudy Gobert, lots of money. Karl Anthony Towns, also lots of money. That is a lot of money stopped into fives, which it's cool that the skill sets diversify enough. But like the only pure shooter of the bunch is Cat, and you know, similar to the John Collins thing, which for your franchise player, you don't want to hear similar to John Collins in this context. But we saw what switches did to Karl Anthony Towns, as Steve in particular has harped on. We saw what switches have done to Rudy Gobert. You you can't really comfortably switch against Naz Reid, but also if he's the one you're not comfortable switching against in light of the other two, that also doesn't seem super ideal. And then you look at the numbers with Naz and Rudy Gobert on the court together last year, the Wolves were outscored by 55 points in nearly 200 minutes. When Naz and Kat were on the floor together, not a large sample because Kat missed a lot of the season, a minus 15 in 85 minutes. So maybe that's more tenable with a larger sample size, but there are defensive concerns with Kat and Naz together. There are some offensive concerns with Rudy Gobert and Naz together. And so it just go, I just kind of go back to, you can't really afford to lose Naz because he's good and homegrown to a degree. And he has a versatile enough skill set to where you can envision him being a big part of two big lineups, but the results haven't been there to this point. And again, that's just a lot of money tied up in the five room.
I've had a tough time with this one, Nikias. Because one, I absolutely want to salute Naz Reid for the work that he put in last year.
Yeah.
Because he deserved it. He earned his way into that. Now, obviously, Kat and Rudy both had absences, but Naz Reid kept showing up over and over and over again, holding it down to the point when everyone came back, you still had to play Naz Reid. Mm-hmm. And so, honestly, it got to the point where it felt like Naz Reid was probably the one person who could play with both of them, as opposed to them playing with each other. And so I get not wanting to lose them. I get, hey, paying a market value. I mean, because if you are big and can do things, you are just going to get that. It's just going to be right there for you. Mm-hmm. 10, 14, 15, you're really good at 20. And then I guess the hope is, okay, if we pivot and if we trade, we'll still have two. Now, I know a lot of people were like, well, I guess this means Kat's being traded. I don't think so. Like, I think everything is very clear. One, I don't think the GM is going to give up on it too early. Two, if you go back to what Chris Finch said at the end of the season, that they have to do a better job of figuring out how to make it work for those two. Like, I don't think this is just going to be instant, immediate. I could be wrong. This could be the move before the move. Mm-hmm. But if Naz Reid produces, but the role is still the same, you can always move him. If there is a Kat deal, you can move Kat, knowing what Naz Reid does. You know Naz can play with Rudy, and that's important. So that's where I'm like, I totally understand it. But at the same time, that's a lot of bigs.
Yeah.
And you are now locked into double big lineups to a degree. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one thing for Naz Reid to perform and earn his way into the rotation. It's another when you have to play him. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how to explain that. Because on the surface, I think it sounds silly. But it's one thing when you can bench a guy. It's another when it's like, no, we kind of have to play him. He's one of our more important people. So now you kind of there's more of a lean towards, okay, two bigs. Which two bigs? Who plays together when? And then the context is, does it change anything? Like, that's where I'm like, does this change anything for Minnesota in the playoffs? Like, I think it's a very good move, but we still have Kat and Gobert questions. Maybe it's insurance because we have Kat and Gobert questions. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a lot of bigs. And you can't play all three of them together. So who are you going to close with? Or maybe it's not even that serious. And hey, they just want to bring it back. Good vibes. Keep hooping. We'll see what we can do for you. I'm not sure.
It could be. Like, I think, and this is an interesting like continuation of the Atlanta thing, because I think because of the John Collins deal, like a large part of it is just the utilization of John Collins, but also like there was a money factor and just where the Hawks are, like they're not a contender right now. I think if you're following through that logic and seeing how it kind of permeates throughout the league, like I think that alone makes a Kat trade more likely. Doesn't mean it's likely overall, but I think it would be easier for Minnesota to talk themselves into getting there. Just in terms of, okay, well, we traded all this for Rudy and his market isn't great right now. But also he's like important to our defense. Like we were defending at a top six, top seven level with him on the court last year, even with him taking slipping. And that's a lot of money tied in the Kat, who has some playoff questions for sure. Like it wouldn't surprise me if, maybe not this offseason, but if it doesn't work this year, it wouldn't shock me if Kat ends up being the guy. But then I'm like, well, wait a minute, Nikias. Have you literally heard Anthony Edwards speak about Karl-Anthony Towns? that alone might be enough to be like, well, maybe he just ain't going anywhere. In light of, I mean, beyond like Cat also being really good, and he's been like the franchise guy for a long time until like Anthony Edwards just kind of snatched that last year. But yeah, like it's a really interesting situation in Minnesota, which, you know, similar to the Hawks thing, I was relatively high on the Rudy Gobert trade, and that was one that did not end up super well in year one. So we'll see what year two looks like. Again, just a resident smart guy here. But no, I just wonder like what the answers are. And I guess we don't really see that until Minnesota finishes this free agency period, which free agency just kicks off on Friday. Like, I just got to recalibrate my brain. I'm always used to like, all right, moratorium period, like July 6th or whatever. And it's like, no, it's a little bit quicker this year. So just got to get myself ready for that. But anyway, got to see what Minnesota does free agency wise. And then, you know, with a full slash healthy offseason, and if they could play for a month and a half in a row without someone going down for like 3 months, that would be ideal. So even if it doesn't work, at least you're able to fully exhaust your options. That would be cool to see in Minnesota. Like, let's fully exhaust it. And if it doesn't work, we make the pivot from there. And I think that's where, if that pivot is coming in the front court, it makes sense that you have Nas on, honestly, a value deal for what he does. Again, it's hard to overstate like how versatile he is offensively. This is a guy that can knock down threes, not just knock down threes, but knock them down above the break. Those are high value. He definitely can put the ball on the deck. Like, I cited this stat during our Bleacher Report stream that I had to apologize for the Nas Reed inclusion. But among, I think, 199 players with at least 200 drives last year, the Wolves generated 1.19 points per possession on the possession featuring a Nas Reed drive. That was fourth in the NBA, behind Joel Embiid, Luka Doncic, and Kevin Durant. The fact that he could even find himself in that company is wild. Like, it's also a little bit of sample size. Again, 200 drives. But he has legitimate ball skills. And with the way that Chris Finch likes to use his bigs, we've seen it with Cat. We saw it with Nas Reed, the delay stuff, just letting him operate above the break. That leads to some fake handoffs and drives from there. Like, he has a real level of versatility to him. He's a fun guy to have around. And so, like, in theory, he could space enough and could drive enough to make the him and Rudy pairing work offensively. And he definitely can fit alongside Cat because of the way that he can shoot. And that opens up some of the driving lanes and stuff for him there. But to your question about the front court and like how they close and stuff, it gets even more interesting. Cause I mentioned like Cat, Rudy, Nas, like that's a lot at the five. And like Nas could play some four, but no, he's going to be best utilized at the five, I think. You also have Kyle Anderson, who was very important for them. And was basically the Rudy whisperer until activities. We'll see if Taurean Prince is back, but he also plays some four. Jaden McDaniels can play the four. Can you get to Jaden McDaniels at the four with all of this? Like, the lineup versatility, I think you had big lineup versatility questions heading into last season, which had tip to you. There are even more questions in light of how important Kyle Anderson proved to be, how good slash important Nas Reed proved to be, how important Taurean Prince's shooting proved to be. And then the question marks that we had with Rudy and Cat. It's like, this is a lot. Like, this is a fun, like, oh, we can have some jumbo lineup options on 2K. That'd be cool. Like, catch me on Play Now online. But that's a lot. And then once you zoom out to the big question, which I think has now tilted to how do we fully maximize what Anthony Edwards can be, it's fair to wonder, who is his ideal pick and roll partner? It does not appear to be Rudy at this stage. But like, what is the ideal spacing context for him? Who is the ideal backcourt partner alongside him? How do we do this? Because as we've talked about Anthony Edwards throughout our pod history, and one of the things I've harped on is like, man, he can get to the rim whenever he wants to. Why does he settle for these jumpers? Like, there's a shot selection thing that Anthony Edwards has to work through. But also, it's going to be a little bit harder for him to get to the basket at will if he's always playing with two bigs. And he even made comments about that throughout the regular season. Like, man, the paint's cramped. And like, we rightfully took that as like a Rudy shot. It was funny, but also the Rudy fit was looking clunky, but that's also fair. How do we get 9, 10, 11 free throw a game Anthony Edwards if he's always in two big lineups? And one of the wings is going to be Jaden McDaniels, who can knock down shots, but he isn't at the point to where he's a hard closeout now, to where it opens up real driving lanes for Anthony Edwards. Like, these are real things that the Minnesota Timberwolves are going to have to consider moving forward. and how they shape this thing throughout free agency with the little bit of leeway that they have. Because again, this is a lot of money tied up in the bigs. This is a lot of money tied up, period. It's not like they can just spend on a $25 million guy. This very much feels exception plus minimum. This is an exception plus minimum situation for them. How are they going to do it? I'm excited to see what they do, but there are some real question marks heading into this one. So shout out to Nas for real. That man is good. But also, Minnesota, you have some work to do. Do you have any closing Nas/Wolves thoughts?
No, I think you nailed it at the end. I'm intrigued, but Nas earned his deal. Wolves at least have insurance knowing they got bigs. What they do with the rest of it is going to be fun to watch. So we will see. But also.
Yeah. Speaking of but also, I guess we can shift to the W now. We'll start with the not fun news before we get celebratory and stuff. I think the not fun news is going to go a little bit quicker. So the Phoenix Mercury and head coach Vanessa Nygaard parting ways. A 17-30 record through two seasons with Vanessa Nygaard. She only had Brittany Griner for nine of those. She has not had Skylar Diggins-Smith this year, which that seems important in terms of the, you know, the talent. The Mercury are 2-10 this year. They're last in net rating. It just has not been a fun time for the Mercury overall. I guess before I go, because I have thoughts, like what were your initial thoughts when this came through?
It's weird. The types of losses were just adding up a little too much.
Yeah.
To me, like if you're getting blown out by Seattle, it's tough to, what I mean? Really push the turnaround. And that's the second loss to Seattle this year. So, I mean, if you look at the last five games, lost to Seattle, lost at the Mystics by a lot, lost at the Liberty, lost to the Aces by a lot, and then got blown out by the Storm. So it's like, all right. My mind also goes to, in the Steven Silas vein, did Vanessa Nygaard ever get to do the job that she signed up for?
No.
But, and that's where I'm like, how do we process and think about the things that happened during that? Like last year, Brittany Griner just gone with no answers. We have no information. Tina Charles contract divorce and everything that came with that. The whole clown emoji, all-star, DT, Skylar Diggins-Smith thing.
Yeah.
Couldn't afford that during that season. Make the playoffs, but no one's there. when you're in the playoffs. Then you get Brittany Griner back. But you have no Skylar Diggins-Smith. And I think I was higher on the Mercury to start, so I'll take my L here. Mm-hmm. But early on, you could see, okay, I understand what they're trying to do. Do they have the folks to do it, though? And as it went on, it's like,
they do not.
Not so much. And then it's like, oh, they also can't guard. The defense isn't great. So it's like, hey, Brittany Griner, please do stuff. Diana Taurasi, please do stuff. Sophie, are you making shots? Shug Sutton, please help us.
Mariah Jefferson,
please help us.
Yeah, this is like
Kelonieri, please help us. And then you look up and you're down 20. It's like, oh. So I was more just like, dang, that's tough. It's kind of tough for all parties involved. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, like my initial thoughts were, one, I'm surprised that this happened now. Like, I figured, especially in light of, again, they just haven't had Skylar this year, and we're not sure if they're going to have Skylar this year. That's a whole nother thing. We're not sure if they're going to have Skylar this year. Like, they've had the stretch with BG and Diana Taurasi missing games at the same time. It's just like, okay, like, maybe you just wait to the end of the season, just go full reset and see, like, what you want to do with this roster, because it looks like you are very much just heading for a very fruitful pick in next year's draft. But then as you cite some of the stuff that came up last year, like clown emoji stuff and everything like that. And then there were like some comments over the weekend that were weird. And then she's fired and immediately like one, just quick shout out to Nikki Blue for getting the interim tag for the rest of the year. But also, like, the comment there, just like, the players have a renewed sense of confidence. I was like, wait, that's interesting to read based on, like, how this happened and how quickly it happened. And I just wonder if, like, the locker room stuff, like, maybe there wasn't anything, like, toxic or anything. Like, I don't have any reporting on that front. But maybe the locker room just got to a point where I just don't want to hear her anymore. And if it got there, then it's worth doing so even in a season like this. Where, okay, we already know we're not making the playoffs with this roster. Let's just go ahead and rip the Band-Aid off. Let's get through this. But with her, it was also just hard for me to judge, like, how good of a coach she was, like, just tactically. And I made, like, a mini tweet thread about it. It's like, I felt like the offense was a little, like, bland from X and O's perspective. But, like, also, how many shooters did they have on the roster in her tenure? How many movement shooters specifically did they have on the roster during her tenure? And, like, with no Breonna Turner there, I mean, with no Brittany Griner there, like, who was your roller last year? Like, it's Breonna Turner, who is notably not a scorer. And you talk about the defense, like, if Skylar isn't there, what is your point of attack? And if you, you know, get to the stretch of games this year where there's no Diana Taurasi, which would help you on the defense front, but then also no Brittany Griner to clean things up, you have Breonna Turner, who is an elite defender in her own right, but then you have the offensive questions. And then who do you have alongside Breonna Turner? I don't know. Like, in terms of the Mercury are bad, it feels more like the personnel has real flaws. And then the good players that they do have up top were unavailable throughout this 2-year stretch. More so than Vanessa Nygaard is this awful coach who can't get it done. Like, I can't get there with what I saw based on what the context was. But once you also factor in, it just didn't feel like she was a galvanizing force. From the outside looking in, I can understand how the Mercury make that move. So I'm curious to see, like, what the team looks like tactically. Like, from a personnel standpoint, like, I'm just going to be transparent. Like, I don't know how high the ceiling is. Like, I don't think this is an elite basketball team. But I am curious to see, like, okay, what are the things they're going to attempt to do with this personnel? And how does that differ from what Vanessa was doing? And so even if the results aren't there, if I see better process, I'm like, okay, that may be where the step up was from. I can see more creativity here. It's easier to project what this could be or what types of players they should be looking for heading into the offseason. So we will see. But man, it's just been a really weird. We're so far from, like, the opening weekend and how dope that was to see Brittany playing and just the general excitement around the team and the franchise. And now it's 2-10. A coaching fire. Not ideal. Also on the not fun front, we will go to Connecticut. Bree Jones suffered an Achilles injury. She is out for the season. She was in the midst of averaging a career high in points and rebounds and assists and also steals. One of six players in the W that was ranked in the top 20 in points, rebounds, and steals, joining some names you might have heard of, Breonna Stewart, Asia Wilson, Nneka Ogunwuke, Nafisa Collier, and Satu Sabally, all-stars. It stinks for Bree Jones, first and foremost, and I hope she is able to recover fully and she's going to be good to go for next season. On the, like, silver lining front, I am intrigued by Alyssa Thomas, you are now the five, and what that means for Connecticut moving forward. They are 2-0 since Jones' absence. The new starting lineup is the Tisha Heideman, Tiffany Hayes, Rebecca Allen now in as an extra spacer. Dewana Bonner sliding down to the four and Alyssa Thomas at the five. A plus 11 in 24 minutes so far with that starting lineup this year, or since the injury. It's a plus 13 in 27 minutes overall, so only 3 minutes of time with that lineup before the Bree Jones injury. I want to see what that lineup looks like with a larger sample. Because as we've kind of talked about with Connecticut, their offense, it does feel like better flow in the half court. I quibble with some of the, like, pace stuff because they still generally play slower overall, but it does feel like the half court tempo is a little bit better. There's more connectivity in the half court for sure. And now you're just adding more shooting in the lineup that opens up more room for Alyssa Thomas to operate, which, what a player Alyssa Thomas is. I have more thoughts on that. We'll move. But more space for Alyssa Thomas to operate with more driving lanes for the guards. I think it's really going to help Letitia Hyman, who's had a weird start to the year, and Tiffany Hayes, who's just been good this year. So we'll see what that looks like. But again, overarching theme, I just hope Bree Jones is okay and is able to fully recover and be fine. A lot of words.
Nah, I hope Bree Jones is good. Hopefully she is able to recover. Big bummer, especially with the season Connecticut was having, especially with the opportunity that Bree Jones had in front of her, as far as starting goes. Mentioning that lineup, I am very interested to see how much that opens up for Connecticut, spacing-wise. Because while you can post Alyssa Thomas, you don't have to post Alyssa Thomas. And then does this up the aggression defensively? And does Connecticut maybe turn things around there, become more active? Because the big thing is two games, two wins, but two games where the defense was said, you guys just aren't going to score.
Yeah.
And that's where it becomes, okay, does this get a renewed effort from them? Can they now drive on the other end? Does it open up more opportunities for their guards? Do we see a different Tiff Hayes? Do we see a different Dejanay Carrington? Do they have more opportunities? Does Harris have more opportunities? Does it open them up that way? Because they're not going away. But that's the one thing about the Connecticut Sun. You just got to accept it. They're not going away. They're going to be up there with their Aces and I guess the Liberty. And I guess the Mystics.
I love the I guess.
Well, nah, it's funny. You got the two super teams who don't want to be called super teams and the two other teams mad at the super teams who don't want to be called super teams.
Y'all ain't super anyway. Like, okay, well, you know what? Fair enough, fair enough. And to their point about, you know, one, just getting a larger sample and them getting some tests, like as we record on a Tuesday morning, Sun Liberty, once again, get to see what that looks like. It's going to be fun. On Saturday, we get Sun Aces Part 3. Aces close win the first one. The Sun gave the Aces their first loss of the season after that. So we're going to see some tests with this new lineup and just new rotation in general. So we will see what that looks like. And now we can transition to the primary, well, I won't say the primary news, but like the happy news of the weekend. Announced on Sunday, we got the All-Star starters for the W. The split is similar to the NBA's, 50% of the fan vote, 25% media vote, 25% player vote. So your starting guards, four of those, Jackie Young, Jewel Lloyd, Arike Ogunbowale, Chelsea Gray, your six front court players, Asia Wilson, who was also the leading vote getter. She's going to be a captain for the All-Star team. Breonna Stewart, she was second in votes. She's also going to be a captain for the All-Star game. Brittany Griner, third. Satu Sabally, fourth. Aaliyah Boston, fifth. Nneka Gumake, sixth. So those are your 10 players. Steve, what were your initial thoughts when this came through the pipeline?
I was fine with it. I mean, I think I was a little surprised that Satu and Aaliyah were in, but that was the same surprise I had before. So I think I had Elena Deladon in, but if Satu and Aaliyah Boston are in, plus the other three were locks to me, there's only so much room. So salute to Satu for the year she's had. Salute to Aaliyah Boston for the year she's had. And the interesting part is like, Aaliyah Boston was right there with the players. She was six with the players.
Mm-hmm.
The media who had her out. Satu was consistent across the board. I wasn't as surprised. What were your thoughts to start? And I guess actually I'll get my guard thoughts out the way early. Those are also the four I had.
Okay.
Like I just didn't. I wasn't going to be surprised the Aces got two. But that's pretty much how I felt. What about you, man?
Okay.
Like this man said he had a rant and threw me the ball.
What you mean? I knew I was similar to the John Collins things. I knew I had a lot of thoughts. I'm just like, you know what? Let me not speak for like 10 minutes straight. And like, Steve, what you think? Like, well, I have 12 things to respond to. I don't know what I think right now. So I wasn't going to do that to you. But I think first and foremost, congratulations to everyone. That's funny. But congratulations to everyone. And I think just looking at the 10 who made it, like, I have some quibbles and some disagreements, and I will get to those very shortly. But, like, in terms of the actual pool, like, there wasn't anyone that I, like, super disagree with. It isn't a, what are you doing here? Or, like, to go to, like, the, I guess if we go to the NBA side, like, there's no Andrew Wiggins on the list for me to where, okay, you're good, but I don't know if you should be All-Star starter. Like, I don't have one of those. I prefer this player, but I don't have anything egregious on that front. I think the closest I get to egregious on the All-Star front would be Alyssa Thomas not being a starter. Because she is, at worst, a top three MVP candidate this year. She has been the best defender in basketball, in my opinion. She leads the NBA in triple-doubles as well. At last check, we'll have to see. I didn't see if the stats updated from last night's game, singular. But last check, Alyssa Thomas was leading the WNBA in rebounding and was second in assists. That is not what front court players typically do. And once you also, again, you also factor in she has been, in my opinion, the best defender in basketball. I don't know how that's not All-Star starter.
Oh, if I could explain. So the fans voted her 10th and the media voted her 4th and then the players voted her 7th. So they added all that up, you know, 50, 25, 25, all that good stuff. And that put her 7th, just two points behind NECA. That's how. Fair, I help you out there, bud.
Thank you for that, Steve. I appreciate that. Her being 10th in the fans is just fun. Like, it's, you know, it's funny to me. Alyssa Thomas is just not a popular player among, like, outside of Connecticut. And the Connecticut fan base was not enough on its own to get her in. So, like, fine. I did look at the media rank, though, and it was just like, okay, she was 4. Which, one, that gets her the All-Star starting spot. But, like, y'all had Satu above Alyssa Thomas this year? I don't get that one. And I say that as someone that has been very high on what Satu's done this year. I feel like Satu has been the Wings' best player this season overall.
Are you conflicted? I'm very confused. You were at the front of the Satu train for at least a year and a half.
I think it's fair to say Satu has been tremendous. The shooting has fallen off a cliff, which saddens me. But, like, it's fair to say Satu's been tremendous while not also saying Satu's been better than Alyssa Thomas. I don't think that was ever true. I think they're both worthy All-Star starters. I just don't think Satu's had a better year than Alyssa. So, like, even the media being the lone group that had her as a starter had her behind Satu. So I'm just like, okay, what exactly is the disconnect? Because I think Satu's been very good. Is this more surprise that Satu made this kind of leap when healthy? Because if it's just the on-court merits, like, it's hard for me to get to Satu's been better than Alyssa.
It's a split, though. I don't even think it's necessarily directly Satu or Alyssa Thomas. It may just be people have their locks. And more people had Satu as a lock than most imagined, honestly. To me, I said it before, Asia Wilson, Stewie, and Brittany Griner were going to be there.
Correct.
Aaliyah Boston getting to that level, boy, that changed the math.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had already gone in saying Satu's been great this year, she's an All-Star, how many spots do you have left? They all gonna be there.
They are.
You mean to tell me Elena Delladon is the 9th best forward? Is that what you're telling me?
Hey,
man. Just her and Nafisa Collier. Hey, y'all exist. Y'all good.
We appreciate you had to.
Yeah, not this year, but y'all good.
Which I wish B got a little bit more love than she did. But it was a tough feel. Like, I'm with you, though, just to quickly bounce off of that. Aaliyah Boston really changed the math. Because it felt like, especially with first returns, for me, it was like Aaliyah Boston's been very good. The fans are going to love her. I don't know if I can get to All-Star starter. To the last 2 weeks she's put together, where it's like, oh, nah, she's in. That's, mm-hmm. No, it's not just really good plus fans love her. It's Aaliyah Boston's great, and she's basically averaging 20 and 10 over the last 2 weeks. And is firmly the best player on her team already. After having like a 4-day offseason between the NCAA season, the draft, and now the W season is what it feels like anyway. Like, no, she's just legit. I don't have real thoughts for Aaliyah Boston. Like, with that said, like, do I think Alyssa Thomas has been better? Yeah. Like, again, like, if I'm just ranking the front court players, like, I really think it's been Stewie, Asia, AT this year. And I wouldn't hand wave away a, like, AT over Asia season take this year. We'd rather have Asia moving forward and stuff like that. But, like, just in terms of what we've seen so far this season, like, I wouldn't be upset with an Alyssa Thomas over Asia take this year. And so, like, she's firmly top 3 for me. But I don't really get the hand ring over Aaliyah Boston as a starter. Like, I think if you're going to nitpick at one of the six, like, I think you start with like Satu and the efficiency dropping plus the wings just on this losing streak. Or Brittany Griner has played 9 games this year. She's been very good, but is the lowest of the group. So, like, I think if you're going to quibble about who does Alyssa Thomas start over, I think it's one of those two, more so than Aaliyah at this point. But again, it's not like Brittany hasn't played an all-star level when she's been on the floor. So that's been dope. And again, Satu's had a very good season overall. So I don't have Alyssa, I think, should have gotten more love, but that's kind of where I start. The guard group, like when we talked about this, I had Alicia Gray over Arike. I think I still would, but that's still not a bad choice. Like, Arike would be my fifth guard in that case. And ultimately, if Jackie Young was a front court player instead of a back court player for voting, which I still don't quite understand,
this
man, then we wouldn't have to look. I'm just saying, man. She's literally the 3 in Vegas. She is literally the 3 in Vegas, and she was the 3 in Vegas last year, and she was the 3 in Vegas the year before that. I just, you know,
all right,
at so least give her the dual eligibility. Like, I just
let's do the math. Let's do the math here, bud.
Okay,
if Jackie Young was a front court player, do you know how much hell that would be trying to figure out who the top 6 are? You just did a whole rant. And Jackie Young would have knocked a whole nother person out.
And that's fine, because she's been better. I don't mind it. Like, if Jackie Young was classified as a front court player, like I believe she should have been, like, Jackie Young is the 4th forward for me.
Okay.
Stewie, Asia, AT, Jackie. And then we figure out what the last 2 spots are going to be. It would have been tough because the group is talented, but that feels pretty straightforward to me.
Okay, I see what you're doing here.
And then my 4 guards are just what the 4 guards are.
So you want Kelsey Plum to be an all-star? You want the whole Aces line to be all-stars? Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm saying, like, if Arike is in, like, that would just be... I guess Kelsey would be in. Like, I would have Alicia Gray. But, like, my point was basically, like, I would have Alicia Gray and Arike swapped. And so if Jackie Young isn't there, then... I'm fine with it just to be Arike would just be there. Kelsey would still probably be 5 for me. Knocking down shots again, so there's more of an argument there. But
she's ranked number 1, 1, and 2.
No, I understand. I'm saying my personal ballot. I'm not my 4 guards. They were Jackie, Jewel, Chelsea, and Alicia. If Jackie was a front court player, then my 4th guard would be Arike. That's what I'm trying to convey. Anyway, please put some respect on Alyssa Thomas' name. Were there any other, I guess before we close this out, were there any other ballot choices that caught your eye during this?
The player vote for Sabrina Ionescu?
Yeah. 19 in the player rank for Sabrina is stark. Like, that's just funny to look at. 6th in the fan vote, 6th in the media, 6th in the fan vote, 6th in the media vote, 19th in the player rank. Diana Taurasi ranked higher in the player vote than Sabrina did. Like, that wasn't super surprising. Like, I just didn't see that one. Also, just seeing how inverted things were for Kelsey Mitchell, 10 in the fan rank, 13th in the media rank, which Kelsey below Diana in the media rank. I have a lot of questions. But anyway, 10 in the fan rank, 13th in the media rank, 5th among the players for Kelsey Mitchell. They really respect what she does on the offensive side of the ball. Pick and roll, ISO, the drives, the pull-ups, the off-ball movement. She is one of the hardest players in the league to cover. So that does not surprise me at all. That we got there. I'm on surprise. Like, I guess, like, it's another year of Elena not ranking high among, like, the players, which is interesting to me. Like, I figured, like, her brand of bucket getting and what she does in the mid-post and below, like, it would be a similar man. It's really difficult to guard her. So, like, I wonder what the disconnect is there. Because I don't... you know, I'm not sourcing anything. Like, I don't think they care about like games played like I would as a fake voter right now. So I do wonder like what the disconnect is there. Like, Elena's been good this year. Like, again, I think there was a little bit of a slide in efficiency over the last four or five. And that's where I'm like, okay, well, I see where Satu, NECA, et cetera, et cetera. But at her peak, Elena Deladon is what, top six, top seven at her best? Like, it's, I don't know. Her just being ninth among the players is interesting to me. What's up? Your face is telling the story.
You had her 11th last year, but it's fine.
Because of games missed.
I'm very interested to see what the bench looks like. And we should dive into that next episode.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have fun.
Three guards, five front court players, four players in any position, regardless of conference.
That's going to get nasty. Yeah, three guards, right?
Three guards, five front court players, four players at either position, regardless of conference. Mm-hmm.
And these are going to be the coaches handling these. So I would guess the two Kelseys plus Alicia for the guards. And then we'll dig deeper into it on next episode. Mm-hmm. That's going to be fun to think through. So we are what, about an hour in? We have a couple of mailbag questions. I want to get to this pair of mailbag questions from Michael before we get into free throws and close things out.
Okay. Michael.
There we go. So he says, hi, Steve and Nikias. I have two more general basketball questions for you. So we'll start with the first one. If you were a head coach, what would your ideal offensive and defensive systems be?
What you got?
I was about to ask you, actual, like, coach. What do you mean?
But I haven't done any coaching in 7 years. I'm washed, dried, and folded. Offensively, we are playing with tempo. We are playing with pace. We're playing with movement. We're playing out of delay, drive and kick, put pressure on teams, pick and roll, keep the ball moving, quick decisions. Defensively, we need to do a little bit of everything. Build on versatility. Definitely want to be an early help team, close back out, help and recover, multiple efforts. But usually probably stick with drop, maybe get to the level, throw some switching out there. Mm-hmm. Depends on who I got, but that would be my idea. Of course, you need to base it on your personnel that you have. Like, don't go in there with your vision and be like, nope, this is what we're doing. Well, yeah. Our team can't do that. Well, nope, this is what we're doing. No, those coaches don't usually last very long, but that would be my idea. What say you, sir?
For me, I think my office system would be like a blend of, like, I'm very pro Monty and what Phoenix ran. So I guess a mix of like the Monty pick and roll / elbow stuff. The Will Hardy off-ball movement. And then I would just take the general love of guard screening in Golden State system. I'm just a nerd for that kind of stuff. So I would try to blend those if I could. I would like to be like a moderate pace team. I don't think I want to be fastest team in the league, but I'm not trying to grind it like Miami either. Like, give me like a good 12th in pace and we can mix in whatever we need to mix in based on what the defense is doing. I think that's where we want to rock. Defensively, I have evolved past my anti-drop take, but we would very much be an at the level / switch team, I think. I think that would be my foundation. And so, as you said, like, it's based on, you have to build around your personnel. But in an ideal world, I would want a big that could just operate in a level and then either trap out or switch if necessary. Like, I don't want the conservative stuff. Let's fly around a little bit. And we can flatten you out with switches if necessary. That's kind of my ideal fun.
So you Tibbs?
I knew that was coming. Oh, that's so nasty.
Tibbs, or you Doc? Also, 12th in pace last year, according to NBA.com, would be the Sacramento Kings. So,
oh, well, there we go. Yes. There we go. And the Sacramento Kings were what? The best offense in the... Anyway. The second question from Michael, what historical players would you most want to watch if they were to play in the modern era with full modern training? Can I get slandered real quick?
Go ahead.
My very first thought was Elgin Baylor.
Is that slander?
I just want to see what that looks like. The drives, the pull-ups, like that. He'd just be very fun with modern medicine. Beyond it, though, I mean, the obvious ones, like, what does Bird look like in this era? Stuff like that. So I tried to go a little bit off the beaten path. Like, Eldridge would be my super old, like, obvious one. Honestly, anyone from the 60s, I think, would be fun. Let me see what Eldridge looks like, what Wilt look like, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond that, like, I think Detlef would be fun. More modern medicine, I guess. We did get some 90s for him, but I think Detlef would be, like, a really fun shout in today's NBA. What say you?
Rasheed Wallace
mm-hmm.
would probably be one I would like to see. Shaq would be fun, but I don't really count Shaq because he was modern adjacent. He's close yeah. enough to it where I have a pretty good idea. Like, it'd be fun to see him, like, with full medical and load management. Like, what would that look like?
Yeah.
Bob Cousy doing cone drills would be fun.
Bob Cousy would have left, but go ahead.
Charles Barkley is always the one for me.
Because
I feel like there's a whole lot you could do with him in this day and age, so that would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could go real deep. Like, Glenn Rice, for some reason, I'd like to see what that bucket getting looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just turned to, never mind, not going to say that. Chris Webber would be fun,
mm-hmm.
I feel like. And you want to go old? Like, how old do you want to go?
I mean, Elgin Baylor was my first name, so I mean, if that gives you any kind of baseline.
The great Bill Russell would have been fun. You know what, man?
What's up? Now the brain's turning. We did it.
Luol Deng. But he's modern adjacent.
Let's say we got some Luol Deng at the four in Miami. Revitalize the career. I always think fondly of that 15-16 team. But
what kind of force would Dominique Wilkins have in the modern NBA?
A lot. A whole lot.
Like, what would Dominique Wilkins and Clyde Drexler look like in their prime in the modern NBA?
Would Clyde also have a left?
All right, see. No.
Do you have free throws?
No, do you have free throws? You can't do that. You can't do that. Does Clyde Drexler have a left? Do you know who you're talking? You can't do that. Why do you do that?
My apologies. I'll ask my free throws very quickly, and then we can get out of here. What's a play or scheme thing that you're really enjoying in the W right now?
Unders. Pick and roll coverage, honestly. I forget who asked the question about WNBA guard play, and then ever since then, my brain has been locked in. Okay, why is it different this year? Or why does it feel a little bit different this year? Why are some of the numbers off for some of these players? And I'm looking, I'm like, wow, these are a lot of unders in pick and roll. And boy, these teams go right to rescreens pretty automatically. That's fun. But wow, that's a lot of unders. And if it's not an under, it's two on the ball. If it's not two on the ball, then it's like, those feel like the base coverages. But that's it. But that's what you're getting. You're not going to lead the dance here.
No drop for you. Okay. Who's having the most underrated season in the W to you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wasn't ready for that. Who's having the most underrated season?
Yeah. Yes. Act as your pseudo shout out section. Who deserves more love?
My pseudo shout out section. You didn't trust me to have a shout out section? it's a lot of Smith for me.
Okay. I got you. Got you. Who do you think gets the first non Alyssa Thomas triple double this year?
Ooh.
As Steve thinks, Alyssa Thomas has two this year and has flirted with many others. She's also the only player in the W to have one so far this year. So.
Chelsea would have to grab a lot of rebounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's my issue with it.
You know what my dark horse answer to this is?
I'm just going to go Jewel Lloyd.
Okay.
What you got?
My dark horse answer would be Candace.
Really?
Yeah, because I think she'll be close enough to the basket for the rebounds. She'll get the offensive board / post fade away and like the outlets and stuff. The Aces use her as an entry passer enough. She uses her as a hub enough. Like, that feels like a very, she had 12, 13, and 11 type game.
Are we sleeping on Stewie here?
Like, honestly, the Liberty probably have the two best candidates overall, if I had to guess, between Stewie and Sabrina.
I think Stewie would just be held by the assists. I don't think Jewel Loy could get enough assists and or rebounds to accomplish the goal. This is a fun question. I enjoy it.
There we go. We're going to do an episode on it soon, but who is your MIP right now?
Oh, dang. I was still looking up... I'm still looking up the other ones. Satu Sabli for me.
Okay. Better defender this year, Natasha Cloud or Brittany Sykes?
Brittany Sykes.
Okay. Shakira Austin or Ryan Howard this year?
Shakira Austin.
Okay. Also, get well soon with Shakira. That injury did not look fun. We'll get an update. We'll drop down the pod as well. Natasha Howard or DeWanna Bonner?
Ooh. Ooh. That's tough.
Yep.
DeWanna has had herself some games this year. I'm going to go Natasha, though. Natasha Howard is extremely consistent at going ahead and getting these buckets. Yeah, that's where I'm going.
Hey, get them up, all-star. All right. If we can agree that Chelsea Gray is the best high-volume passer in the league, who's second?
Oh, you really thought about these, didn't you?
Hey, man.
Courtney Vandersloot?
Okay. Last question I have for you. is Kevin Durant top five?
Yes. Kevin Durant is top five. Top five of whatever he wants to be, man.
There we go.
Keep doing your thing, Kevin Durant.
There we go. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your pods, you can find us. Also, if you're watching this video on YouTube, naturally, subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel if you haven't already. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. We're watching plenty of W games, watching some wrestling, whatever else comes on. I think we're going to end up sprinkling in some like 2K streams soon, some older NBA content as well, and some off days. So just stay tuned on that. Link's going to be in the description. So enter your information there. It is free, no shenanigans. If not, just copy and paste the link. If it's not hyperlinked for you, again, it's free, no shenanigans. Come rock with us. Come have some fun. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Oh, the Kings want Chris Middleton? Okay.